good horse, I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this we go riding.
You're listening to episode 625 of Unwelcome Guests, Jettisoning Accustomed Categories of Thought. I'm Robin Upton, and this show is something of a continuation from last week's show. Our main content is going to be part two of Richard Wolff's Marxian Class Analysis and a continued reading from David Graeber's Debt, The First 5,000 Years. But to help us jettison accustomed categories of thought, as David Graeber says, it's a necessary precondition for getting out of the debt trap and formulating new categories of thought. Let's hear a few words from gift economy theorist Charles Eisenstein.
In the future, career counselors, they won't say, okay, so you have these gifts, how can you use these to make a living? How can you commercialize these? How can you make money from these? The career counselor will say, what would you like to give to the world? What do you do that feels good? Greed is not a fundamental aspect of human nature. Greed is a consequence of scarcity. If you and I are living in incredible abundance, such as used to exist 200 years ago, the fish were so thick on the water that it looked like you could walk across the rivers. Under those conditions, greed is ridiculous. If we're sitting among piles of apples that have fallen on the ground, you know, it would be ridiculous for me to like gather them all to myself, and I'm not going to get my pile when there's other piles sitting all over the place. If you do not have a perception of scarcity, then greed is a foreign emotion. What we've done is we've created scarcity. The money system creates artificial scarcity where there need be none.
You may wonder, if there was such abundance, why did people get greedy and destroy it? As David Graeber's documented, most of the plunder was carried out by foreigners who themselves were feeling trapped in debt. There's a quote from Charles Eisenstein: it is not the propensity to consume that bears no limit. On the contrary, limitless desire arises with money. After attaining a surfeit of consumables, people covet money itself, not what it can buy, and this desire has no limit.
It's an abstraction. It's bits and computers. But we associate it. We use it to exchange things that do come from nature. So if you use something that's unnatural and use it to buy and sell things that are natural, then you're going to have a problem. If the unnatural part expands exponentially and forces the natural part to expand exponentially too.
Another quote from Charles Eisenstein: money is so fundamental, so defining of our civilization, that it would be naive to hope for any authentic civilizational shift that did not involve a fundamental shift in money as well.
A healthy economy shouldn't be thought of as a separate entity, you know, from the natural ecology, but as an extension of the ecology. And so what do we have to do to make an economy operate according to ecological principles? The decaying currency recreates this. The main principle is waste is food. There's no externalities. You know, you don't start with raw materials and end up with toxic waste. But everything that's produced, you know, like the manure of a cow, is food for the worms. And the manure of the worms is food for the soil organisms, and that's food for the grass, you know, and that's food for the cows. So it's a closed loop, a circle of the gift. And that's another reason why I like the decaying currencies, because they obey nature's law of return. They decay and then can be reborn in a different form. The challenge today is how to recreate the gift economies of yore in the context of a mass society.
To enter more deeply into right livelihood, bow in service each day. Trust your desire to give. Remember how good it feels, and be open to opportunities to do so, especially when they are just at the edge of your courage.
Sacred economy is an economy in which everybody is an artist, and in which everybody's gifts are applied toward a beautiful purpose, a purpose that's beautiful to them. And collectively, we will reorient our thinking to what can we as human beings create that's beautiful to us. And beauty will become the new motivating program, and instead of security or survival or domination. But I mean, that's what our divine gifts are for. You know, we're supposed to look upon our works and say, that's good.
To give and receive, to owe and be owed, to depend on others and be depended on, this is being fully alive. I think, very generally, what Charles Eisenstein is saying here could be talked about as a switch from a general pattern of fear to a general pattern of love, from insecurity to security. This is, I think, an essential topic, but when we're going to have to leave this show, I'd welcome your thoughts on good speakers on that transition. We had one from David Corton, long time ago now, a couple of years back, on The Great Turning. If you know any speakers in that vein, then I will be very interested to hear. Now let's continue. This is part two of a Marxian class analysis by American professor of economics, Richard Wolff. And he's not just looking at economics. He's giving an overview, really, the economic and social trends in the US. And whilst you might be familiar with the details, I hope that the bigger picture is one that you find new and helpful, as well, of course, as the illustration of Marxian class analysis as a practical tool.
Today, I want to introduce the second of our five sessions by briefly going over, summary-wise, what we did last week. And the point there of our discussion last time we met was to introduce you to the specifics of Marx's own contribution to class analysis, his particular way of understanding class, which, as I stressed, was new and different from how other people had understood and used class analysis. Other people long before Marx, other people at Marx's own time, and other people since Marx. Because the uniqueness of Marxian economic analysis, and particularly his class analysis, has been underappreciated, which is part of why this class exists. So what is the key difference, as we went over it last week? Basically, and this is just a summary, I pointed out then that for at least thousands of years of human history, human beings have used a class analysis of sorts to understand their societies and to try to change them. By far the most typical or most frequently used notions of class had to do with the following: that class is about groups of people in terms of how much property they do or do not own. The class of the rich and the class of the poor. The class of owners, the class of the dispossessed. The haves, the have-nots. And that lots of people, both those who liked societies as they were and those who wanted to make changes, thought it was very important to see who had property, who didn't, and to examine the relationships and tensions between them in terms of how that shaped and changed society and how a change could be achieved. In other words, they had, to make it simple, a property theory of class, a property definition. Those who have it, and those who don't. And that's how they made sense of society. The second, very different tradition, also very old, also thousands of years old and older than Marx, had a concept of class very different. In this second view, classes were defined by having groups of people that were different from one another, group one and group two, not according to the property they owned, that was the first theory, but rather according to the power they wielded, the authority they had. Whether they gave orders to other people or they took orders from other people. Who had power and who doesn't? And there you get notions of the ruling class, the one with power. The powerful versus the powerless, which is very different from the rich versus the poor. Why? Because you can have power and not have property. Barack Obama has a lot of power, but when it comes to property, not much. And there are plenty of people I could introduce you to who really have oodles of property, but wield relatively little social power. In other words, how you understand a society will be different if you think that the crucial difference and distinction is who owns and who doesn't, from what you think and what you understand about society, if you rather believe that what matters is who has power and who doesn't. But in any case, whether you're a property theorist of class or a power theorist of class, those ideas, those ways of thinking about society, long predate Karl Marx. Now, Marx was interested in them. He was a student of them. He thought it was very important who has power and who doesn't, who has wealth and who doesn't. He commented on it all the time. But that's not his unique contribution. If all Marx did was to make use of the concepts of class in terms of power and property, then he would be one of a long line of people who used those ideas, and he wouldn't be the outstanding theorist that obviously he has been for the last 150 years. In world history, Marx contributed something new and different. And what I tried to do last week, and I'm not going to recapitulate at all, was to point out that Marx had an urgent interest. He felt that the great goals of the French Revolution, which were his great inspiration, the revolution that happened 40 years before he's born, and was the intellectual beacon, if you like, for his generation, that the goals of liberty, equality, and fraternity that animated the French Revolution had not been realized by the middle of the 19th century when he became a mature young man. And he asked himself the question, as many of his contemporaries did, why did the French Revolution, with all its great hopes and ideas, why did it not succeed? Why did we not have, in the Germany of 1848, for example, a society that could be described as having liberty, equality, and fraternity? In fact, it had nothing close to it. So he said the project to revolutionize society by changing the configuration of property and changing the configuration of power, both of which the French Revolution did. The French Revolution took the power from Louis the, what was it? 16th. And all of that. It transferred power to the Estates General, to a parliament. Radical change in the distribution of power. Radical change of the French Revolution in the distribution of property. One of the acts of the French Revolution, you may not know it, was to take the property away from the Roman Catholic Church, which was the largest single property owner in French society at the time. Oh my goodness. And to take power from many landlords, feudal landlords, etc. So property was radically altered and power was radically redistributed. So Marx asked himself, why did that not achieve? Why did that not set us on the road to the liberty, equality, and fraternity? And his answer was, we, the left, of which he felt a part and was a part, we missed something. We didn't see something else that goes on in society that we needed to understand and we needed to change, not only because it needs to be changed on its own terms as an ethical and moral thing, and I'll get to it in a minute, but we also have to change it because if we don't, our attempts to change property and power will also come undone. We won't be able to sustain even what we can change, so we have no choice. So what is this other process in social life, this other quality of society that Marx fixated on? And the answer is captured in one word, which I will elaborate briefly. And that word is surplus. An idea that doesn't exist in distributions of property and power, because they're not about that. Here's what Marx figures out. In all societies, human beings, the adult human beings in the community, have to do a certain amount of work. That is, they have to use their brains and their muscles to transform nature. They have to get together to convert a tree into a table, to convert a sheep into a shirt, to convert, and so forth. Take things from nature, rework them with their minds and their muscles to make the goods and services that the community depends on to survive and to grow. And in every human society, of no matter what the place, no matter what the time, the following thing, Marx said, is going on. Those adults who do the work, who use their brains and muscles to transform nature, to produce goods and services, and here comes the punchline now, always produce more goods and services than they themselves consume. They always produce more shirts, more hamburgers, more loaves of bread, more houses than they themselves, the working adults, consume. The difference between their output and the portion of it that they themselves consume is the surplus. And in every society, that surplus gets distributed. That's how the people live who don't work, whether they be old, sick people, or children, or anybody else in the society who, for whatever reason, is withdrawn from the work process, but needs to get a distribution of the surplus in order to survive. And all societies, whether they're conscious of it or not, and Marx is very clear about this, have to organize the production and distribution of surplus. And the question is, how do you do that? Societies differ, Marx said, in how they do it. But even more important, how each society organizes the surplus shapes everything else that goes on in that society. And so if you don't pay attention, if you don't even recognize that that exists, then part of what's shaping your life, you are blind to. You do not understand, and therefore the chances of your deliberately changing it to make it work better in your life are virtually nil. In a sense, Marx's introduction of a new way to understand class, now class about who produces the surplus? Who gets the surplus? How do they distribute it? To whom do they distribute it? What are the social consequences of all of this? Marx's revelation that this is part of analyzing a society and part of any real, reasonable, hopeful program to change it is a discovery of something people had not understood, except in bits and glimpses, and he refers to some of those. He kind of puts it together. In a sense, he does for the anatomy of society, this exposure of the surplus, something like what Freud does for the anatomy of the mind, the discovery and the analysis of the unconscious. And in a sense, Marx is saying, let's make conscious this organization of the surplus. Marx then, in his mature life, develops an analytical argument all built around this surplus. For example, the three volumes of Capital. They really begin in Capital Volume 1 with Marx showing how the surplus can be identified and located in capitalism. And I went through that last week in a brief summary way as follows. When you go to work in a capitalist environment like the United States today, and you sit down with an employer, and you negotiate with that employer over your job, you get to a point in the conversation where the issue is your wage. And let's suppose you and the employer reach an agreement, you will get paid $20 per hour of your work in this enterprise. The following is true in Marx's analysis. The only reason the employer would hire you to work in his or her establishment and pay you $20 an hour for adding your brains and your muscle to the production of whatever it is that enterprise sells, haircuts, hamburgers, software programs, whatever. The only reason is if every hour of your labor added more than $20 worth of output for him to sell. If he didn't get more than he paid you, he wouldn't hire you. In Marx's language, a condition of work is that you produce a surplus that somebody else gets. You produce it, but you don't get it. The employer gets it. In modern United States, that means, the bulk of the employers being corporations, the board of directors, usually a group of 15 to 20 people, gets the surpluses produced by all of the workers that use their brains and muscles to produce the commodities the corporation sells. Okay? So that's how Volume 1 explains that. Volumes 2 and 3 then explore what do the employers do with the surplus they get from their workers? How do they use it? And how does society develop and change as a function, as a result of how the capitalists take the surplus and deploy it, distribute it? So I have here a summary. We didn't do this last week, but I thought this would work as a summary. The vertical rectangle, TL, stands for total labor, the total labor done by the worker. Marx divides it into two parts. NL, that stands for necessary labor, and SL, that stands for surplus labor. The definition? Simple. Necessary labor is the amount of work the worker does, the fruits of which are paid to the worker as wage and salary. So it's necessary in the sense it's the labor you do as a worker necessary to earn your salary, your pay. But you are required to do surplus labor, more labor than what is necessary to sustain you. Why? Because you won't get a job if you don't. They're not hiring you to come and do just enough so that they can pay you. There's nothing in it for them then. So you must do surplus labor. The fruits of your surplus labor, the portion of your output that is surplus to what it is that has to be used to pay you, goes to the employer. In Marx's language, the capitalist, the employer, appropriates the surplus the workers produce. And then they distribute it. That's what this arrow is. Who do they distribute it to? Well, here's one group. The managers. Managers don't make objects. They don't make commodities. They manage the people who do. That's what a manager does. And so they get a cut of the surplus for managing. Here's another one. Shareholders. The people who own shares in the company live 1,000 miles away. They do not produce anything in that company. They have an ownership claim. Maybe they own stock that they inherited from their grandmother. It doesn't matter for our purposes. But the corporation typically distributes to the shareholders a portion of the surplus. It has a name, this thing. It's called a dividend. The corporation pays a dividend to the shareholders. That's a part of the surplus. The corporation also has to have lawyers because it gets sued. It has to pay. The lawyers do not help make what the corporation does. They never set foot in the production process. But they get paid. How do they get paid? Out of the surplus. The government comes in and says, you got to give us money. You have to pay taxes. Good. The surplus pays the taxes. The corporation, to compete, has to have research and development. It's called R&D. They have to invent new commodities to sell. People are tired of having a toaster. They want a toaster that works in the shower. So you have to have a toaster with a new, and you can sell toasters that work in the shower in a way that the flat old toaster is of no interest. Okay? So the surplus, and what do they all have in common? The language of Marx himself. Capitalists distribute the surplus in order to continue to be capitalists. In a sense, They have to. It is not a choice. You know, in the fiction of the left, we have capitalist as Mr. Moneybags, a kind of round guy in a black top hat, the caricature. And the image may be, even in some of your minds, of the capitalist taking his surpluses and going to the Bahamas and sitting on the beach and drinking alcohol drinks with little umbrellas in them and all that, right? Not possible. Marx made fun of that. The capitalist has to go and secure his conditions of existence. The capitalist must use the surplus to stay as a capitalist. For example, must pay the manager. Why? Because if he doesn't, here's what the workers will do. They will arrive at 9 o'clock. They will be drunk. They will be high. After 15 minutes on the job, they will head into the bathroom and not be seen again for several hours. You need managers. They don't do anything. They make sure that the workers do. You have to have that. Otherwise, you will die as a capitalist. Shareholders. Why do you need to give them a dividend? Because they buy your shares. They give you the money with which to function as a capitalist. If you tell your shareholders you're not getting any shares, any dividends, they may sell your shares, and then you're stuck. Can't have that. Why do they pay lawyers? Because given the stuff they produce, you're going to sue them, and they have to make sure that you don't win that case. Why do they pay taxes? That's easy, because the government will shut them down if they don't. That's a condition of their existence. They can't survive as capitalists if they don't pay taxes. And why do they do research and development? Because other capitalists do, and if they don't keep up, they're dead. They'll be continuing to produce the toaster that doesn't work in the shower. You won't buy that one. You'll buy the one that works in the shower, good for the company that made it, spent money, but not for the company that didn't. So if you take your money as a capitalist and go have a good time in the Bahamas, you're going to disappear. Marx was an analyst of the system. And this is how the system works. Capitalism has a unique way of producing, appropriating, and distributing surpluses. And that's really what volume 1, 2, and 3 of Capital, that's what they work out. In much more detail, of course, than what I just did here. But it's Marx's surplus analysis. Marx never did anything comparable in the way of analyzing the surplus of non-capitalist systems that he did to capitalism. He wanted to analyze capitalism because he lived in it. He wanted to analyze capitalism because he wanted to get rid of it. So that was his interest. However, he spent a little time, and many Marxists since have spent a lot of time, trying to use this analysis in the way we're going to in the next four sessions. That is, apply it, see how it works when you apply it to other issues, other questions. And one of the issues that Marx himself began and others carried forward was to ask about how societies have organized the production and distribution of surplus in different ways from how it's done in capitalism. And I'm going to end my recapitulation with that. He identified four other ways, in general, that societies have organized the surplus other than this capitalist way I just described. So I'm going to go through them with you. But before I do, one more word to introduce that applies to capitalism and some of the others. It's the word exploitation. And in Marxian theory and in Marxist class analysis, this is a key word, and it has a very simple, precise definition. Exploitation exists, it occurs, if and only if, when and only when, the people who produce the surplus are different from the people who get it and distribute it. That's it. Not very complicated. So capitalism is exploitative. Why? Because the workers who come to work in a factory, an office, a store, are not the same people as the board of directors that gets and distributes the surplus. Those are different people. Different groups of people do the production of surplus as compared to the appropriation and distribution of it. Two other systems, radically different from capitalism, nonetheless share exploitation. One of those is called feudalism, and the other one is called slavery. These are Marx's designations. Feudalism. Here the arrangement is, again, some people do work and keep a portion of the fruits of their labor, but they also do surplus, which somebody else gets. But it's not a worker hired by a capitalist employer. That's capitalism. In feudalism, you have something called a serf and a lord, using the European example. In other cultures, they have different names. In European feudalism, by the way, it worked like this, just to give you an idea of the range of difference. Serfs were assigned pieces of land. By the way, this system existed in Europe from roughly 500 or 600 AD to around 1600 or 1700. So it's a system that lasted over 1,000 years just in Europe, and it has lasted for long periods of time in other parts of the world as well. And as you'll see a little later, it exists here in the United States. Lots of it. Any case, in feudal Europe, the serf and his or her family had a little plot of land, or several little plots around a piece of land, and they farmed that, and they kept the eggs and the wheat and the corn, and they lived off of that. And they worked there Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, every week. Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, these serfs had to do something else. They left their little piece of land, and they went to the land owned by the lord of the area, and the area in Europe was called a manor. Manor. And they worked on the land of the lord Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and whatever they produced there, the lord kept. At the end of Saturday, they went home, had a big party, and then Sunday morning went to church to rest on Sunday. You know the ritual, okay? And so they produced necessary labor Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday on their own land, surplus labor Thursday, Friday, Saturday on the lord's land. They kept the fruits of their own. The lord kept the fruits of their surplus labor. In other words, the producers of surplus, the serf, and the appropriator of the surplus, the landlord, were different people. Hence, feudal exploitation. But why is it not capitalism? Many reasons. First of all, the relationship between the appropriator of the surplus and the producer was not an employment relationship. Serfs didn't get hired by anybody. There was no labor market. There were no wages paid. It's a radically different system. Serfs typically were bound to stay on the land where they were born. They couldn't go anywhere selling their labor power, which all of us assume we can do, because we live in capitalism. Okay? So that's feudalism. Slavery. Here's another interesting system. The people who do the work, the slaves, work all day, every day, 6 days a week or longer, and the fruits of what they produce is entirely taken by somebody else, the master. Not only do the slaves not get the fruit of their labor, they themselves are property of somebody else, which is not the case with a feudal serf and not the case with a proletarian worker in capitalism. That's a really big difference. But here's what they all have in common. The slave does the work, produces a surplus. In fact, the slave, everything they produce belongs to the master, but the master, not being too stupid, usually, gives a certain portion back to the slave because he realizes that you've got to do that, otherwise this game is over. The slave will die, and dead slaves do not produce a lot. So, portion is given back to the slave, but a bunch of it is kept by the master. So the slave has produced the surplus appropriated by the master. So they're exploitative systems. Serf, slave, proletarian. But there are two other ways of arranging the surplus that are not exploitative. And here they are. Number one, Marx called them ancient. That has a strange name for him to have used because they existed a long time ago. But Marx himself points out they exist always through history. And I'm going to use the name we're most familiar with here in the United States for these people. Self-employed persons. Interesting. The man or woman who runs their own little craft-making operation. The man or woman who produces software programs with their laptop in their garage. The man or woman who's a dentist or an architect and works on their own. Self-employed, all those kinds of people. The dog walker who collects dogs from the neighborhood and, you know, does or does not pick up afterwards and so forth. These people are interesting because the person who produces software, healthcare, whatever it is, does how much work? Enough work to take care of their own needs? Never. Always do, here we go, more than that. Not just to pay their own income. Why? Because they have to pay taxes to the government too. They may have to have a lawyer also for their business. They have lots of expenses they need to produce a surplus to take care of beyond themselves. So they produce a surplus, but here comes a big difference for Marx. The person who gets the surplus is the same as the person who produces it. No exploitation. And that makes it a very interesting class structure. Always has existed. Just a little footnote. In American culture, that is the most revered, admired, and celebrated class structure, not capitalism. Capitalism exists in our culture with a bad conscience. What we celebrate is the ancient. It's what Thomas Jefferson wanted the country to be. Didn't work out that way, but it's what he wanted. Two-thirds of my students, I think I mentioned this last week, when I hand out cards at the beginning of class each semester and I say, what do you hope to be doing 5 years after you graduate from college in terms of your economic situation? Big smile, men and women alike. I want to be my own boss. No chance in hell. But they believe it. They hold on to it. That's what they want. And that's why they'll be so unhappy in that cubicle on the 18th floor of the skyscraper, which is where they're going to end up. But they dream about, they fantasize about. And you know, imagine a left which understood what I'm doing and which could say to the mass of Americans, you're dreaming of a non-exploitative class structure, you quasi-Marxist you. And let me tell you that that's an interesting thing. You probably hate being exploited. Otherwise, you wouldn't fantasize about this. But let's leave that. I'm just trying to tantalize you. What's the fifth and final one? The one that's most interesting to Marx. The one that Marx likes. Because he doesn't like any of these others. Communism. In that arrangement, the following works. Groups of people, workers, get together as a group. They produce whatever. Software, ladders, shirts, hamburgers, it doesn't matter. They produce enough to sustain themselves and they produce a surplus. But here we go now. Who gets the surplus? The collective of workers themselves. They appropriate collectively their own surplus and they distribute it as they see fit to reproduce this communist organization of the surplus. All of these five alternatives, communist, self-employed, feudal slave, and capitalist, the five, all of them have existed on and off for thousands of years. Most societies are combinations of them. We went through that last time, including the United States today, which has all five. We did that last week. Every society, therefore, has in it whatever the tensions and contradictions are within each class structure, interwoven with all the tensions and contradictions among and between class structures. All of that is going on. Marxian class analysis, therefore, is very complicated. It bears no relationship to the caricature of the capitalists and the workers. Stop. Let me give you an example. How do you handle the worker, the American worker, right? The American worker who goes to work on Monday to Friday in a factory. On Saturday and Sunday, to make a little extra money, he has a truck. And he makes deliveries and moves people's equipment and moves homes and has a plow on the front to move. He works on his own on the weekend. He is his own boss on the weekend. And let's see, his wife, she makes craft articles which she sells to a local boutique. She works on her own and they have a teenage son who goes to work in a factory. That family would occupy multiple different class positions. Are they in the working class? What would it mean? In Marxian theory, you have to do a complicated analysis to see how people relate to the production, appropriation, and distribution of surplus, because for Marx, that's what has been missing. That's what has to be understood. And that's a very different question from asking what property these people own, or what power they do or do not wield. Power and property are important, but they are different from the issue of people's relationship to the production and distribution of surplus. This was the core of what we did. And now I am going to use this analysis to analyze the current economic crisis. And how am I going to do that? I'm going to do it by teaching you a little, I hope, of American history. Since, as you'll see, the crisis we're in now is as deep as it is, has lasted as long as it has, and will have the enormous consequences it already shows, because it is rooted in American history. It is not a short-term phenomena. It is not some quickie that will be over shortly. This is a deep product of a long history. So let me begin. For most of the history of the United States as an independent country, but at least for the 100 years from the 1870s to the 1970s, a century, the following statement was true. American workers in capitalist enterprises kept producing more and more per hour of their work. To use the language of economics, American workers experienced for 100 years, at least, and it may have been more, going back earlier than the 1870s, they produced a rising output. Each hour of work generated more goods and services this year than last year, and less this year than next year. The productivity of American labor went up for that 100 years. That isn't so surprising. But the next fact is, for those 100 years, the wages per worker, what we call the real wages, the actual goods and services that your wages could buy for you, also went up for 100 years. This process, the capital-labor relationship, the process in which the worker works for himself and works for the boss, produces for 100 years a rising portion of goods and services that you get to enjoy as a worker, even as it produces more and more surplus for the employer. In a sense, American capitalism, for most of its early history until the 1970s, is a stunning example of capitalist success. The workers come to work, they produce a surplus. They are more and more productive, so the surplus gets bigger, that's more money for the capitalists to use to develop, and the portion that they get grows, and so it's a higher standard of living. There is probably no capitalism so far in the history of the world that for so long a period has provided its mass of workers with a rising standard of living. It is American exceptionalism. And why did it happen? And the answer basically is the United States had a problem in its first 150 years that economists will refer to as a labor shortage. We didn't have enough workers. We didn't have enough workers in part because we slaughtered all those that we found here as a nation. So they weren't available. They were dead or hounded into the far reaches of the West or put on reservations. And so we had to bring, as you know, our history is bringing waves of immigrants here all the time to deal with this labor shortage. And the problem was it only partly solved the problem. So for 150 years, the employers had to give more wages because otherwise they wouldn't get the workers. They wouldn't get them to come here. And once they were here, they wouldn't get them to stay in their job because you could always run away west and get some land or get a new job. Or grow some dope or something. And so it was hard, and you had to pay rising wages. And the American class structure, therefore, was very interesting. It wasn't just a successful, stunningly successful capitalism. We went, after all, in about 150 years from being a small, unimportant colony of the big powerhouse of global capitalism, England, to having outstripped England, outstripped Germany, outstripped Japan. Wow, impressive. As capitalist growth goes, stunning. So our capitalism was extraordinarily successful. Brutal, hard. American workers had to work very, very hard. But they had a rising standard of living. That was their compensation for their exploitation. Was that the only class structure in the United States? Not at all. Over those 150 years, the successful capitalism had to deal with serious challenges from other class structures in the United States, which it crushed in most cases. The most famous example, of course, is the Civil War, when the capitalism based in the North and Midwest went to war and slaughtered the opposing slave economic system of the American South, premised on African slaves and a culture producing above all else the number one export that made America a rich country, cotton. America became wealthy producing cotton for export to England. Without that, we would have been a much poorer country to this day. But the problem was, so successful and so wealthy did the South become that it developed the idea that it ought to have a whole country that was slave. And that frightened the capitalists of the North and Midwest, who didn't want a slave society, because that frightened and challenged them. So a war happened that was in part, it had other reasons too, but was in part a war between the capitalist class structure of the North and Midwest against the slave class structure of the South. And that's why Lincoln's proclamation to free the slaves is the death knell of the other class structure. You're taking away that which is the foundation of their class system. They were defeated. But that wasn't all. Around the United States, there were millions of small, self-employed farmers, craftspersons, and they were, across the last 150 years, also crushed. Not by a war, but by being competed out of existence. If you ever want to study anything, the drama of it, from 1820 to today, it's called The Demise of the Family Farm. 800 books you can get like that, studying how American agriculture went from something producing by self-employed farm families, 90% of everything, to today, if they produce 1% of the output, I'd be surprised. Nothing, nothing. Organic turnips and little else. Okay? The end. And the same is true for most other kinds of self-employment. And such self-employment as exists is very subordinated to the capitalists as providers to them, dependents of them, and so on. Well, what about slavery? Did it completely vanish? No. It was crushed in the South where it was serious. But there are pockets of slave class structures here in the United States as well. Prostitution is often organized as a slave class structure. Very interesting in our country. Very interesting. The pimp is the master and the prostitutes are the stable. Okay? Professional baseball has a little of that. One team can buy and sell another players to one another and so on. So we have pockets of it. What? Prison system. Prison system. The 14th Amendment of the United States Constitution outlaws slavery, a product of the Civil War, outlaws slavery. If you ever read that, it's two sentences. It outlaws slavery except in prisons. That's what it says right there in the amendment. So yes, slavery is also a system that exists in our prisons and so on. We have a big prison population, one of the largest in the world, if not the largest. Okay. Feudalism. Is there a way, a society, a part of our culture, where one person produces a surplus for another, no wages are paid, it's not capitalism, it's not slavery in the sense that one person owns the other, it's not self-employment, it's not communism. Do we have feudalism? And the answer is yes, we do. The traditional household. Very simply. The traditional household. The man goes out to work in the morning, comes home at the end of the day. He has a job working in a factory, an office, a store, whatever. The wife, traditional household now, the wife stays home. She's a homemaker. Fine. When she makes the home, here's what she does. She cooks meals to sustain herself. She also cooks meals for the husband. She makes her side of the bed, but she makes his too. She throws her laundry in the washer, but his also, etc. She does work. She produces a surplus that somebody else gets. And don't worry yourself that she may not think of it that way. Most workers in America don't think they're exploited either. This is a Marxian analysis. The household is a place where labor is done. And if labor is done, the Marxist asks the question, is there necessary and surplus? Is necessary produced? Is surplus produced? Who produces it? Who gets it? And how do they distribute it? In the traditional household, the woman produces a surplus for the man. Could be otherwise. You could organize it otherwise. Have the man do it and the woman appropriate it. There probably are such examples. There are a few. We even have a phrase in the United States, I believe, called house husband instead of housewife. But it's rare still, relatively. So feudalism, why do we call it feudal in the household? Well, the answer is it's not a capitalist relationship. Husband doesn't pay wages to wife. Wife doesn't produce for husband a commodity which he sells. That would be capitalist. We don't do that. And she's not a slave because you can't buy and sell wives. So what is it? Well, here's what it is. It's a kind of personal relationship. And you know, interestingly, it's the kind of personal relationship that has that moment, the moment of wedding, when you each swear to be loyal and all the rest to one another. Promise to love, honor, and cherish, or whatever the words are. And I always like to remind people that, in case you didn't know it, the marriage ceremony today has its origin, the very words, in the relationship between the lord and the serf in feudalism. When you become a serf of somebody, you get down on one knee, they take the flat of a sword, you've seen it in the movies, tap you on the shoulder, and the lord swears to love, honor, and cherish you, and you swear it back. And in the relationship of love, honor, and cherishing, you produce surplus for him, but he doesn't do that for you. And likewise in the marriage ceremony, I will love and love and love. It means to the husband, he goes to work, and you do surplus for him at home. By the way, this creates a very complex class analytic, doesn't it? Because we now have to ask the question, gee, might there be a lot of men who are exploited on the job by their employer, and then in the evening go home and exploit their wife? Of course we do. And now what is going to be the consciousness of that man? Which is he going to be more responsive to in his attitudes to politics? His position as exploited or his position as exploiter? And where does it leave the woman? And where would it leave the woman who has to go out and get a job and do that as well as take care of the house? She gets exploited twice. That might create a difference between men and women's attitudes on a whole range of subjects, making the marriage quite difficult. These are some of the interesting ways you can use Marxian class analysis in ways you may not have thought of before. Well, in the history...
I'm sorry, I just have to ask this. Where do you put unpaid internships into all of this?
Unpaid internships be a good question. We'd have to... It's a question I don't have the time to answer, but it's a very good question. And it's the kind of question you could and should, as Marxists, ask of all kinds of workers that we encounter. There's constantly changing definitions of work and job, and we always would ask the question, is there a surplus produced? By whom? For whom? And if you can demonstrate, which you probably can, that interns are often positioned in such a way that they produce, partly they get something and then they produce a surplus, then the answer would be they could be just as exploited under the heading intern as they are under the heading anything else.
Well, I think actually that they're more exploited because all of their surplus...
Go. They get no pay. That's right.
The employer or the capitalist
pays them nothing.
And they pay them nothing. And really the only thing that differentiates them from slavery is the fact that they cannot be
bought and sold.
But aside from that, I mean, it more clearly fits into the slavery
perfect
than into the feudalism or certainly the capitalism, because they're not getting paid anything.
Right. Well, you could call it capitalism with a wage of zero. And that, well, it takes us far afield, but it's a good question. Let me get back now to the crisis. I want you to see how we play with it. Back to the story of the United States. Successful capitalism that smashes slavery in the South, kills it off, subordinates the ancient, the self-employment, but does not smash feudalism. In fact, it celebrates feudalism in the household. The history of capitalism in a Marxian framework is thus the story of a successful capitalism in the enterprise connected to a successful feudalism in the household. They reinforce each other. The capitalist typically pays the man enough money to sustain the feudal household at home. And the wife produces enough surplus for the husband that the employer doesn't have to give him as much as he otherwise would because she's producing. It is cheaper to buy raw food and have your wife cook it than to buy finished, produced food articles in the takeout. Think. What's the difference? Wife in a traditional household. So a symbiotic relationship doesn't have to be, hasn't always been, but in the history of our country, capitalist enterprises complexly connected to feudal households were the norm from the early 19th century even to the 1970s. Okay? Now that's our class analytic. Now let's follow what happens. In the 1970s, a great change occurs. We're now building to the crisis. A great change that is all the more important because most Americans did not know it at the time. There was no public recognition of what I'm about to tell you, no public debate about what it meant, and basically none since either. What happened in the 1970s? Key. Rising wages of American workers stopped and never resumed. The real wage of an American worker today, 2010, in terms of what an hour's worth of your wage will afford for you to buy, is about what it was in 1978. Very important. Real wages stopped rising. For a working class that had enjoyed rising wages for 100 to 150 years, this was a trauma. Remember with me, if you will, what happened in the United States having a successful capitalism that rose wages. First, Americans began to believe they lived in a charmed land. God must love us because he's providing us with a rising standard of living and nobody else. We're special. And not only are we special in our rising standard of living, but capitalism is the best thing since sliced bread because it's providing it to us. Capitalism is great, we are blessed, God loves us, etc. More importantly, American workers who were pressed to work harder and harder across those 130 years with more machines, more difficult machines, longer hours, under greater stress, all of that, came to react to their growing pressure on the job by coming to see the world as follows. Work fundamentally stinks, but you accept it because there's a reward to you from work. That reward has nothing to do with work. It's not available to you in work. The reward for work is located at the mall. The reward for work is consumption. Now that is a very peculiar way of thinking. After all, human beings in the United States, workers, go to work Monday to Friday minimum, 8 to 5 in the afternoon, more or less. Which means you got to get up an hour or two before, you got to get dressed, you got to wash, you got to take the transportation, you got to do the reverse on your way home. The overwhelming bulk of your adult life is all about work. It's an interesting thing to decide that stinks and there's nothing I can do about it. And there's nothing I should do. I shouldn't even look there. The work isn't what matters. It's how much money I have to consume with. That's what matters. And Americans had come to define themselves that way. I'm successful according to the house I live in, the neighborhood I live in, the clothes I have, the car I drive, the vacation I take. You know.